I didn't mean to do this. I'm saying that in advance. And, oh yeah. I'm doing this because I know some people, you know, got to know me through this TV show I was doing a few years ago. It was called Birds of Paradise. It was a nice show. It was on ABC. And I didn't mean to be doing TV or nothing. I mean, don't get me wrong. I was home in Massachusetts, where I've been living for, you know, a long time. And it was getting to be winter. You know, the snow was falling. And I got this call from these Hollywood guys. And they said, "Hey, Arlo, we're going to do a new TV show. And it's called Birds of Paradise. And we want you to be on it." And I said, "Well, that's nice. But I don't want to move to L.A. or nothing." And they said, "Well, we're not doing this in L.A., man. We're doing this over in Hawaii." And I looked out my window, and the snow was, like I said, that deep. It was 14 below. I said, "Yeah, talk to me." So I found myself over in Hawaii for a while. They wanted me to play a part of an aging, ex-dope-growing hippie sort of character. Big stretch, huh? Required all my acting ability, you know. So I showed up there anyway, and I had a great time. And I had been studying up on tropical ballads anyway, so I was ready, you know. Mostly because I had married a California girl a long time ago, and I brought her back to New England to live, and she was mad at me for, you know, long periods of time. I mean, always freezing or something, you know. And I remember even after being married a few years, we was going through a couple of feet of snow one day, and she started up again, you know, bitching and moaning about it. And I finally had enough, and I told her, I said, "You know, if you just took those sandals off and put some boots on, it'd be a whole different world up here, you know." And then she wanted to live on the coast, too, right on the coast. And I know a lot of people think Massachusetts is just on the coast, but actually there's parts up in the hills there, whereas where we live, the coast is about 150 miles away. And I said, "Well, don't worry about it, because the coast is coming to us." And she looked at me like, "Yeah, all right." Now, this is about almost 30 years ago now, and she, like, kept this. You know how people can keep things in their mind for long, especially women, and when you marry them, they remember, you know, I don't know why, it's some kind of ability, you know. And until about 2 years ago, she was, you know, reminding me about this. And then we were watching one of those TV shows on the greenhouse effect, you know, how the world's getting warmer, I don't know, and the ice cap's supposed to be melting now, and the ocean's going to come up and over to our place. She saw that. She said, "You might be right." I said, "I told you." So she hasn't said nothing about me building the boat dock. I've been planting palm trees, you know. Also, I'm going to have the first palm tree farm in New England. That's my plan. It's probably why I'm not rich, but having plans like that. But you know, one of these times. Anyway, like I said, and I've been studying up on tropical ballads, mostly because, you know, it's getting ready for global warming. I wanted to, because my friend Pete Seeger told me years ago, "Arlo, it's a folk singer's job to know songs about where you come from." And so I'd been sneakily studying up on these tropical ballads, getting ready for global warming, trying to get a head start on my folk singing friends, you know. And so anyway, I don't know what else to tell you about it, except that there was one song when I got to Hawaii for this TV show that I didn't even have to learn. This was an old one we used to do years ago, and I haven't really played it on the ukulele until we was out on this tour with, like I said, some of the guys in the Grateful Dead and some other folks, and we was out there, and I want everybody's playing the same, I mean, they all got the same guitars out there, and I thought I'd introduce a little variety into the, you know, and so I came up with this thing, and I didn't know any songs on it except for this one, so I thought I'd play it for you tonight, and I'm not sure I actually remember it, though, like I said, goes something like this. I don't even need a pick for that. I saw the splendor of the moonlight on Honolulu Bay. There's something tender in the moonlight around Honolulu Bay. And all the beaches are filled with peaches who bring their ukes along. And in the glimmer of the moonlight, they love to sing this song. If you like ukulele lady, a ukulele lady like you. If you like to linger where it's shady, ukulele lady linger too. If you kiss a ukulele lady, well, you promise never to be true. But she sees another ukulele lady fooling around with you. Maybe she'll sigh an awful lot. Maybe she'll cry, but maybe not. Maybe she'll find somebody. Because a lot of anybody can get up here and finish a song, you know what I'm saying? But, well, that's true. I never felt compelled to finish a song. As a matter of fact, it reminded me of the time I had to go out to California recently. Not like yesterday or something, but maybe it was a year or so ago. They wanted me to play one of these folk festivals they were having out there a couple of years ago. And I like folk festivals. But they also wanted me to do what they called a workshop. I don't like workshops. I didn't realize, you know, when I got there, but let's see. I used to like workshops, don't get me wrong. Back in the days when you get somebody up there playing like Dave Van Ronk, one of these old guys, you know, and you could watch him and he'd be up there playing, and you could say, "Dave, show me how you're doing that stuff." And he would show you, you know. That was a workshop. Now they don't do that now. Now they put you on the stage with a bunch of other people. And you swap songs on a particular subject or something, and then you go away. And that's not a workshop. So I didn't want to do it, but I found myself up there with a lot of people, and they introduced everybody, you know, and they said, "Welcome to the Topical Song Workshop." I said, "Oh, wow, man. I thought this was the Tropical Song Workshop." Because sometimes when you get something in your head, you know, I've been reading the pamphlet for months. I could have swore it said tropical the whole time, you know. So I got up there, and I was feeling kind of stupid, as you can imagine, you know. Luckily, there was one tropical song I knew. I had just wrote it for this TV show I was doing over there. Here's a new song. Goes something. Oh, actually, I don't even need that. Go with these fingerprints here. See, I knew I wasn't going to have this together. And this is as together as it gets. My old friend Hoyt Axton used to say that. Anyway, so here we go. Are shining in your eyes, or the light is shining in your eyes. Oh. just hard to see, and I learned to tune by sight. Beyond the searchlight stage where we become the stuff of time amid the waves, whose nets are cast along the shore when day is done. As the seabird flies above, my song sung to those I've come to love, the petals strung into the lays, the flowering of days I've just begun. A second chance to grasp a dance beneath the last ray setting of the sun. Tears along the trail of sand, footprints in the water lead me back to who I am. Well, gods and goddesses decreed, the mountains raised up from beneath the seas, the sound of sovereign thrones above the hand-tied bureaucrat who moans. This crazy love amazes me, as I just gaze into your eyes, the liquid sun is spilt upon the sea. I want to be where I can see the moon arise. Second chance to grasp a dance before the moment fades to summer eyes. Tears along the trail of sand, footprints in the water lead me back to who I am. Stretch of sand, reduced to just a woman and a man, bathed in the lunar light, the likes of which I might just understand. Among the myths I know are real, the goddess disguised as herself revealed. I sang her song out loud, she set herself beside me in the crowd. A second chance to grasp a dance into the moment that she would allow. Tears along the trail of sand, footprints in the water lead me back to who I am. I love those songs like poetry, you know, just sort of dripping out of your mouth like dew off the morning vine or something. I started thinking about that because, you know, I've been working on poems. Mostly I've been working on poems for little kids, though. I was kind of getting annoyed. Actually, more than annoyed, I was frankly getting fairly pissed off at the new breed of self-esteem building songs and poems and books that little kids have to put up with these days. I like the old stuff that scared the hell out of you. Gave you a reason to stay under the covers at night. Because the truth is, you know, you start feeling good about yourself and you tend to wander. I know there's more important things to be talking about, you know, and singing about, and I've talked and sung about a lot of things over the years, and I know that in different places there are different things important to different people at different times. And just like back home in Massachusetts now, we've been seeing lots of mooses recently. Yeah, it's probably not a
problem around here, like in Reno, nothing. I mean, you know, I didn't even know you could stay mooses. I read it in a New York Times article about 3 years ago, and it got me to thinking about them. And frankly, the mooses, by the way, that we're seeing in Massachusetts, they don't come from Massachusetts. They're not indigenous to Massachusetts. They've been coming down from Canada. And it didn't start happening until after the NAFTA thing went through. Now, I'm not saying there's a connection. I'm just pointing out, like, one day NAFTA, next day, mooses. Everybody knows about mooses now. They got antlers that grows out. Not everybody knows that sometimes they can grow in. And when the antlers of the mooses grows in, it squeezes their brains. And when their brains get squeezed like that, they start thinking differently. Now, it may not be something you or I would notice, but it's something other mooses would spot right away, you know. Because they start doing stupid moose things like, well, I don't know, I'm not really an expert or nothing, but like, you know, walk in with no destination in mind. Just walk in, walk in, walk in with them big walking moose feet, walk in, walk in, walk in. No? Till they're dead. I don't know. But if they're up there in Canada and they're like walking east, they come to the ocean, decide to turn right, they end up walking in Massachusetts, where we get to see them. Although no mooses have been seen south of us in Connecticut yet, which gives you an idea of the shape the mooses are in while we're seeing them in Massachusetts. With that in mind, and as by way of an introduction, I would like to recite for you this very evening one of a series of moose poems that I've been working on recently from a larger work entitled Assorted Moose Poems. This one's called Mooses Come Walking. Goes like this. Actually, I was doing this about a last year. This isn't the poem yet. But, well, you never know with poetry, you know what I'm saying? But I was doing this about a year ago, I was in California, strangely. And I looked in the back of the room, and standing right there as I was doing this poem was the famous American poet Allen Ginsberg. And I had known Allen since, you know, a long time ago, back in the village days in New York in the 60s and stuff. And frankly, since that time, I never felt like I had much to say to the man. And suddenly, for the first time, I felt like, you know, poet to poet. I mean, you know, he wasn't there at the end of it or nothing, but, well, because poets are busy, got places to go and stuff, you know. But it was, you know, for that one glittering moment, it was just so cool. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. So anyway, here we go. Mooses come walking. Mooses come walking up over the hill. Mooses come walking. They rarely stand still. When mooses come walking, they walk where they will. And mooses come walking up over the hill. Mooses look into your window at night. They look to the left, and they look to the right. The mooses are smiling. They think it's a zoo. That's why the mooses like looking at you. So if you see mooses while lying in bed, it's best just to stay there, pretending you're dead. The mooses will leave, and you'll get the thrill of seeing the mooses go over the hill. I quit writing moose poems after I wrote that. Thought I'd leave it to those, you know, more qualified. Because frankly, I felt that way about songs a lot, too. You know, not the first time I've had to have those kind of thoughts. Because I remember when I started writing songs, and I was a kid in high school, you know, and back in those days, you know, lots of people were going to school and... mostly men. In those days, we was either going to school or visiting Asian nations, all expenses paid. And so I was looking to stay in school a lot. And unfortunately, I got out of high school right in the middle of that mess. And I was looking for a college to go to, and Like I said, I was going to high school in Massachusetts. The nearest college that would take me was in Billings, Montana. I'm not making this stuff up either, I went to school in Billings. I was smart enough to get in, not smart enough to stay for very long, and I flunked out, started visiting American military bases while they was trying to decide what to do with me. And I told them, I said, guys, just trust me on this, man. I'm not worth it. Took them a few years, but they finally agreed. But I remember I missed being in college, you know. I missed being around smart people. So I went back to Massachusetts, thinking they had a lot of schools, colleges, universities, smart people everywhere. You could see them on the street and everything, you know. So I was hanging out with them, hoping that some of their smart would rub off on me. And it was working. I felt like I was getting smarter every day. Till I wrote this song. And that's when I knew, as I found myself going through life, that smart was not going to be a big time word for me. I don't want a pickle. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. See what I mean? And I don't want a tickle. I'd rather ride on my motorcycle. And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. I can't believe I wrote this song. Or that I could make a living singing it, you know. For decades. I love America. It's true. I remember I wrote this as soon as I was out of school, as I was out of college. I remember I was riding my bike. I was going down a mountain road. I was doing 150 miles an hour, playing my guitar. On one side of the mountain road, there was a mountain. On the other side, there was nothing. Just a cliff in the air, but I wasn't paying attention. I was just going down the road. And all of a sudden, by accident, the string broke off of my guitar. Broke right there. Went flying across the road that way, wrapped itself around a yield sign. The sign didn't break. It didn't come out of the ground. The string didn't break. It stayed wrapped around. The sign stayed in the other end of my guitar. I held on to my guitar with one hand. Held on to my bike with the other. Made a sharp turn off of the road. Luckily, I didn't go into the mountain. I just went over the cliff. I was doing 150 miles an hour sideways. 500 feet down at the same time. Looking for the cops. I knew it was illegal. I also knew that that was it. I knew I didn't have long to live in the world. And in my last remaining seconds in the world, I knew it'd be my obligation to write one last farewell song to the world. I took out a piece of paper. Pulled out a pen. I sat back and thought a while, but you know, nothing come to me. It's like writer's block or something. And so I was looking up in the sky for inspiration, you know. And there in the sky, burning in flames across the clouds, was these very words. I don't want a pickle, just want to ride on my motorcycle. I don't want a tickle, I'd rather ride on my motorcycle. And I don't want to die, just want to ride on my motorcycle. Well, I knew it wasn't the most, well, I hoped it wasn't going to be the most brilliant song I ever got to write or nothing, but I didn't have time to change it. Just wrote it down, learned it right away. And of course, the most amazing thing was that I didn't die. I remember I didn't die, because it was just after that I started playing in these little coffee houses, little folk clubs around the country and stuff. Actually, I wasn't even playing in them. I was just going in them with my guitar so I could get in for free. And I'd walk in, sit down, and if somebody who was supposed to be playing didn't show up or got sick or drunk, or they'd look at me and say, like, hey, Arlo, why don't you come on up here and sing some? You know, till we can find somebody good. So I'd get up there, and this would be one of the few songs I knew. So I'd start singing this song, feeling stupid, and embarrassed, ashamed of myself. People were looking at each other like, we paid for that song. So I started talking in the middle of the song, hoping that I could talk my way out of singing that stupid chorus again. And as time went by, the song got longer and longer, till pretty soon I could start this song on one coast and finish it 3 weeks later on the other coast. That's when I quit singing it. Time went by. Years. Decades. I never thought I'd sing this song again. Just a couple of few years ago when I found out, when I discovered that they were studying the lyrics to this song in colleges and universities around the country. No wonder we're in trouble. I don't care. I feel good now. It's okay to be stupid now. Sometimes it's even smart. So now I can sing with pride in my heart. I don't want a pickle. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. I don't want a tickle. I'd rather ride on my motorcycle. I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. One thing I noticed, you know, the older I get, the smarter I look to some people, even if it's totally uncalled for. I mean, people have been coming up and saying, you know, stuff like, Arlo, talk to us about songwriting. Sure, yeah. I don't actually know anything about songwriting, but frankly, this never stopped me from talking about it. I just make up stuff. You know, I don't mean the songs. I make up what I know about songwriting right there on the spot, and I just tell people, and if they walk away happy, I figure I told them the truth, you know. But really, songwriting for me is more like, you know, fishing. Yeah, you're just like sitting there. And songs are going by. Like clouds in the sky or something. And if you got a pen, you could catch them. I know, because a lot went by that was meant for me. But I was busy, you know, watching TV or something important. So they just went to other people, you know. Bob Dylan. People like that. So if you want my advice about songwriting, I don't actually have any except it. Don't be sitting downstream of Bob Dylan. Well, I even wrote to Bob one time. I said, Bob, why don't you throw the small ones back every once in a while? He didn't think it was funny. Well, he doesn't have that happy camper look a lot anyway, you know. Oh, he's written some great songs. Matter of fact, maybe I'll do one of them. Let me see here. I just got to remember what I know. I got some Bob Dylan song. Don't have to worry about tuning much either. I remember one time, though, he's not the only one. I remember one time I was playing with Pete Seeger at Carnegie Hall, you know. Carnegie Hall, you know. And we was up there, and then some nights is just, you know, it's different than other nights, you know. Some, you can get through a whole night sometime, never have to tune nothing. Other nights, you tune all the time, and this was one of those nights. Pete was having trouble. He was 70-something years old. He's up there, he's got this big, long-neck banjo he plays. And he's up there tuning. It's not like here, you know. And, I mean, this was Carnegie Hall, and people were nowhere near as nice to him as you just were to me. I mean, they're going like, and sometimes when you know somebody pretty well, you can see, you know things about them that other people don't see right away. And I could tell Pete was getting pissed off. He was boiling, you know. Somewhere in there, in that sort of Pete Seeger veneer, there was, you know, and he couldn't say anything. He couldn't do nothing about it because, you know, he's Pete Seeger. So he just looked up and said, well, wonder why folk singers tune all the time. You know, you never see classical players tuning and stuff. He went back to tuning. Actually, he said, it wasn't just glad. He said, wonder why you never see Segovia tune. That's what he said. Just folk singers tune all the time. And he went back to tuning. Then after a while, he looked up and said, we care. I loved it. Let's see if I got this on this other guitar. I know I'm supposed to have this stuff together, you know, but like I said, oh yeah, I gotta plug it in and everything. It's more like fishing than I thought. When the show just moves right along, you know, just. What? Yeah, you can keep the air on. Don't bother me. Not one of those, you know, gotta be absolutely silent while I play every note, you know. There are people like that. Probably don't play a lot here. It's what I was going to do. Frankly, there's a lot of places they don't play. But they're fun to go to, you know, and just do like, I can't do it. You know, like make weird noises, you know, and stuff, piss them off. I love that. I shouldn't be saying that stuff, though, about it. Anyway, like I said, I have fun with Bob Dylan. Telling stories about him. As a matter of fact, one time, I was having to play in, where was it, somewhere down around this part of the world, Tucson. Yeah, that's close enough. And, from Massachusetts, I mean, it's this part of the world. And I had never been to Tucson. This was back in, very late 60s. I don't know, 68, 69, somewhere back. And there hadn't been many places at all. Been to Chicago or something, you know. And I'd never been to Tucson. I got a phone call before the date was booked. And I thought, man, okay, I'm going down, you know. And I got a phone call from a Tucson newspaper. Called me up, said one of these pre-show interviews that they were going to put in the paper, you know. They said, Arlo, you realize that Bob Dylan's going to be playing in town the same night as you. Why would anybody come hear you? And this was in the days when I guess Bob had stopped doing a lot of the songs, the great songs he had written in the early 60s and was on to other things. And I still loved some of those early songs. And I told the guy in the newspaper, I said, well, if people really wants to, you know, go hear some great old Bob Dylan songs, they might have to come hear me. And they printed it. I mean, I didn't think they were going to print it. I was just being a smartass on the phone, you know. So I get to Tucson, there's lines around the block at our show that night. And I'm in the dressing room before the gig with my Bob Dylan songbook.
realizing I didn't know that many Bob Dylan songs. And I had to learn a whole lot of them all in one night, you know. It's not easy because his songs are weird, you know. I've kept him in my mind since that time. We're talking almost 30 years now. And since that day, we have never played in the same town on the same night. So I keep the songs in my head thinking that's what's doing it. You know what I mean? Anyway, like I said, he's written some great songs. This is one of my favorite ones. Let's see if I remember it all. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Though I know the evening's empire's returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I'm branded on my feet. I have no one to meet, and these ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Though you might hear laughing, spinning, swinging madly across the sun, it isn't aimed at anyone. It's just escaping on the run. And before the skies, there are no fences facing. And if you hear faint traces of skipping reels of rhyme, your tambourine in time, I wouldn't pay it any mind. It's just a ragged clown behind a shadow you're seeing that he's chasing. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. Take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped. My hands can't feel to grip. My toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm ready to go anywhere. I'm ready for the fade into my own parade. Cast your dancing spell my way. I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there's no place I'm going to. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you. And take me disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted frightened trees, out to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. To dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the surface sand, with all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you. got the keys to the highway. Lord, I'm booked and I'm bound to go. Gonna leave here running, you know. Walking's just too slow. I'm getting up early, early in the morning. You know I'm gonna put on my walking shoes. When the leather hits the highway, Lord, I'm gonna lose my walking blues.
Take a short break and I'll be back pretty soon.
Just wanted to make sure I was in tune because I knew I wouldn't get a chance to tune it for a little bit. Sometime earlier this year that it'd been like around 28 years since this come out as a movie, and it was 2 years before the movie come out that the record come out, which means it was like 30 years ago that this come out as a record, and it was 2 years ago on the record, which means it was like 32 Thanksgivings ago, 32 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in the restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Baja the dog. Living in the bell tower like that, they used to have a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. Seeing as how they took out all of the pews and having all that room, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, found the place was filled with garbage. We decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the town dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the town dump. We got there. There was a sign, a chain across the road, and the sign said, closed on Thanksgiving. We had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And so with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset, looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we come to a side road. And off of the side of the side road, there was a 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff, there was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile be better than two little ones. And rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obi. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage. Just wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obi. I cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." It was after speaking to Obi for about 45 minutes on the telephone that we finally arrived at the truth of the matter. And Obi said we had to go down and pick up the garbage. We also had to go down and talk to him at the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one of two things that Obi could have done at the police officer station. The first thing was he could have given us a medal for being so brave and honest on the telephone, which wasn't very likely. We didn't expect it. Of course, the other possibility was that he could have bawled us out and told us never to be seen driving garbage around the vicinity again, which is what we expected. But when we got to the police officer station, there was a third possibility we hadn't counted on. And we was both immediately arrested, handcuffed. I said, "Obi, I don't think I can pick up the garbage with these handcuffs on." He said, "Shut up, kid. Get in the back of the patrol car." We sat in the back of the patrol car and drove to the, quote, scene of the crime, unquote. Friends, I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this was happening. They got three stop signs, two police officers, and one police car. But when we got to the scene of the crime, there was five police officers and three police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years, and everybody wanted to get in the newspaper story about it. And they was using up all kinds of cop equipment they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plaster tire track footprints, dog smelling prints. They took 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. They took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner and the southwest corner, and that's not to mention the aerial photography. It was after the ordeal we went back to the jail. Nobody said we gonna put us in a cell. I said, "Kid, I'm gonna put you in a cell. Give me your wallet and your belt." I said, "Obi, I can understand you wanting my wallet. So I don't have any money to spend in the cell, but what do you want my belt for?" He said, "Kid, we don't want any hangings." I said, "Obi, did you think I was gonna hang myself for glittering?" Obi said he was making sure, and friends, Obi was. Cause he took out the toilet seat so I couldn't hit myself over the head and drown. He took out the toilet paper so I couldn't bend the bars, roll the toilet paper out the window, slide down the roll, have an escape and get away. Obi was making sure, all right. And it was about 4 or 5 hours later that Alice... Remember Alice? It's still the song about Alice. She come by and with a few nasty words to Obi on the side, she bailed us out of jail. And we went back to the church, had another Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat. Went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we all had to go to court. be coming with the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. And he sat down. A man come in. He said, "All rise." And we stood up. And Obi stood up with the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures. And the judge walked in with a CNI dog. Sat down. We sat down. Obi looked at the CNI dog. And then at the 27 8x10 color glossy pictures. Looked at the CNI dog. And Obi began to cry. Because Obi come to the realization that this was a typical case of American blind justice. There was no way the judge is going to look at the 27 8x10 color. Well, it didn't matter, because we was fined $25 each. We had to pick up the garbage in the snow. But that's not what I come to talk about or nothing. I just thought I'd mention it, though. Because I know there's probably a lot of people sitting here tonight thinking this is one of those nostalgic ballads or something. Man, I hope so. Because they still got that building over New York City on Whitehall Street. And others like it all around America. And that's where you used to have to go get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. I remember I had to go in there one morning a long time ago for a physical examination. So I got good and drunk the night before, because I wanted to look and feel my best when I went in that morning. I mean, I wanted to look, I wanted to feel, I wanted to be like the all-American kid. When I went in that morning, I was hung down, I was brung down, I was hung up, I was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking things. I walked in, I sat down. Give me a piece of paper, said kid. See the psychiatrist, room 604. I went up there. I said, "Shrink, I want to kill. I mean, I want to kill. I want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead bird bodies. I mean, kill, kill, kill." And I started jumping up and down, yelling, "Kill, kill." And he started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down, yelling, "Kill, kill, kill, kill." Till the sergeant come over, pinned a medal on me, sent me down the hall, said, "You're our boy." I didn't feel real good about it. I proceeded on down the hall, getting more injections, inspections, and all kinds of stuff that they was doing to me at the thing there. And I was there for 2, 3, 4, 5 hours. I was there for long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. They was inspecting, injecting every single part of me, and they was leaving no parts untouched. But I proceeded through, till I finally come to see the very last man. I walked up, I said, "What do you want to see me about?" He said, "Kid, we only have one more question. Ever been arrested?" I told him the story of the Alice's Restaurant Massacre with five-part harmony, full orchestration, all kinds of the phenomenon. He stopped me there. He said, "Kid, did you go to court?" I told him the story of the 27 8x10 color glossy picture, circles and arrows. He stopped me again. He said, "Kid, I want you to go over, sit down on that bench that says Group W." "No, kid." I went over there. Group W, where they used to put you if you may not have been moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime. There's all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking people on the bench. There's
mother rapers, father stabbers, father rapers. There's father rapers sitting there on the bench next to me. I mean, they was mean, nasty, ugly, horrible, crime-fighting guys. And the meanest, ugliest, nastiest one, the meanest father raper of them all, was coming over to me. And he sat down next to me and said, "Kid, what'd you get?" I said, "I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $25 to pick up the garbage." He said, "Kid, what was you arrested for?" I said, "Littering." And they all moved away from me on the bench there. Till I said, "It's creating a nuisance." And then they all come back and shook my hand. We had a great time on the bench talking about crime, mother stabbing, father raping, booze smoking, cigarettes and all kinds of stuff, having a good time. Till the sergeant come over. He had some paper in his hand. He held it up. He went like this. He said, "Kids, this piece of paper got 37 words for 7 cents. Well, no time to crime, detail the crime, and get insane. Too new about the crime, the rest of the officer's name, kind of thing got a saying." He talked for 45 minutes, but nobody understood a word he said. But we had fun filling out the forms and playing with the pencils on the bench. And I wrote down the massacre like I was supposed to. Put down my pencil. Turned over the piece of paper. There on the other side of that piece of paper, in the middle of the other side, away from everything else on the other side, underlined and capitalized, read the following words: "Kid, have you rehabilitated yourself?" I went over to the sergeant. I said, "Sergeant, you got a lot of gall to ask me if I've rehabilitated myself. I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench. I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench, because you want to know if I'm moral enough to join the army, burn women, kids, houses, children, villages after being a litter bug." He said, "Kid, we don't like your kind. We're going to send your fingerprints off to Washington. A friend somewhere in Washington, enshrined in a little folder, is a study in black and white. But my fingerprints, they're still there. The only reason I'm singing the song tonight is because some of you may be in a situation like that sometime sooner than you're sitting right here thinking about it. And if you ever find yourself in a situation like that and you don't know what to do, well, there may not actually be anything that you could do, but there's something you can try. That's to be wherever it is you're supposed to be. You just go in there, you sit down, you go, 'Oh, shrink!' You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant and walk out." Imagine one person. I mean, even today, walking in singing some Alice's restaurant, walking out. They're going to say, "Hey, that guy's 30 years too late. Get that guy out of here." Imagine two of them walking in hand, singing in harmony. I don't know what the problem is anymore, but imagine three of them. No, they might think of some kind of organization. Something, or maybe 50 people a day going in singing some Alice's restaurant, walking out. Friends, they might think it's a movement, and most of them be too young to know what a movement was. That's what it was. It was the Alice's restaurant anti-massacre movement. That's what it was. I guess that's what it is. That's what it's always gonna be. And all you got to do to join is to sing it with me as it comes around again on the guitar. With feeling. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want. Can't start singing louder just at the end or something. You would have thought after all this time, you would have learned by now. If you want to end war and stuff, you've got to learn to sing loud all the time so people can hear you. Now,
I know this is a long song. Believe me, I know. It was pretty long when it first come out. It was like 18 minutes or something. I'm not trying to make it any longer. Though I could. I'm still not proud. Or tired. The other thing is, you know, I realize there's people sitting here tonight that probably don't believe that songs can change the world or that songs can change the destiny of nations. Of course, I wouldn't blame you. I wouldn't have thought so myself. Of course, I know something some of you may not know. I'm not making this up now. Because I remember back when I was reminded of it during the last election we had. Because I remembered back, when Jimmy Carter was elected. Because I got an invitation to his inauguration. And I knew I had to go. Because I knew it'd be the only one I ever got. Been right so far. I went down to Washington, D.C. for Carter's inauguration. And it's just like you see on TV, people partying everywhere. Everything was fine. I swear I'm not making it up. Everything was fine until long toward evening. Somebody come and tap me on the shoulder. And I turned around. And it was Chip Carter, the president's son. He was a little younger than me, but I recognized him. I said, "Chip, how you doing?" He said, "Arlo, I've been looking everywhere for you." I said, "Chip, how come?" He said, "Arlo, I've got something very important to tell you." I said, "Chip, what is it?" He said, "Arlo, we were moving our stuff into the White House, and in the Nixon record library, we found a copy of your record, Alice's Restaurant." I looked at Chip Carter. I looked deep into the man's soul. I said, "Chip, was it open?" And in slow motion he nodded, "Yes, it had been open." And I want you folks sitting here tonight to know that I did not think about that for a long time. Till about a year or so ago when Richard Nixon passed away. We was all thinking about him, and well, there may be some people here too young to know, but see, Richard Nixon was the president of the United States. And he used to like to tape stuff. I mean, if you can imagine a world before VCRs and cassette decks was everywhere, you can imagine a man who was truly ahead of his time. He taped everything that went on in the White House, and everything was fine until one day they started playing back the tapes, and people found out what was going on in there. But it wasn't anything that was on any tape that got the man in trouble. So much as it was what he had erased from the tapes. But he didn't want people to know what he was listening to, and there was one particular famous gap in one of those tapes that I was thinking about one night when I said to myself, "Arlo, how many things in the world are 18 minutes and 20 seconds long? How many things in the world are exactly 18 minutes and 20 seconds long? Probably just a coincidence or something, but it's good enough for me. So when this song comes around again on the guitar, remember that songs can change the destiny of nations. You just have to know the words and have the feeling. Wait for it to come around again on the guitar. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant, except in Alice. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant, at Alice's
I remember back when I first made some money, which I think was the last time, too. Took all my Alice's restaurant money, and I went up and I bought this old farm out in the country up in Massachusetts where I still live. I didn't know nothing about farms or Massachusetts or money or nothing. I was just a kid, you know. I got up there, and the first thing I noticed was the house didn't have no water in it that I had just bought. So I called up the real estate lady, who was Alice's mother. I said, "This house don't have any water." She said, "Well, didn't you look before you bought it?" I said, "No, I thought all houses came with water." So she gave me the number for a guy down the road, a plumber sort of guy, and I called him up. He says, "Oh, I know that place. You got water. It's just frozen this time of year. You don't have no insulation. That's what you don't got." I said, "Insulation?" He says, "Yeah, you'll get water in the spring." I said, "Well, what are you supposed to do?" He said, "Well, there's a pond out there on the side of your house, isn't there?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, there's a pond out there on the side of your house." I said, "Oh." I went out, chopped a big hole in the ice, about that big. Started bringing in buckets of water. But every day the hole gets smaller and smaller, freezing back up, you know. And at the end of the week, I was taking it out with a teaspoon there. Bring it in there. House come with, didn't have no heat, just had a wood stove. One of these little Franklin stoves, about so big, heated that far out. We lived that far from the Franklin stove. Rest of the house was just for looking at. In those days, James Taylor was living with us. James and me get up early in the morning, not because we were early riser types. We were freezing our butts off. We'd go down there and try and get some twigs going, burning in that Franklin stove. We both had girlfriends and slept pretty late. I married mine. Should be getting up any time now. I remember, though, we'd take this little table, me and James, and we'd move it over toward the stove there, and we'd sit there, too cold to be friendly. Not domestic enough to actually make coffee, so we'd be drinking the stuff from yesterday, sitting there grouchy. So we was writing songs individually, but we never actually worked on one together. And I remember the morning I wrote this song. I remember because the sun was coming up, snow was going down, fire was going out. Me and James are sitting there. So if this sounds a little bit like a James Taylor song, it's because, well, we were both sitting there, and I had the pen. Woke up this morning with my head in my hand. Come on, children, come on. Snow was falling all over the land. Come on, children, come on. I don't know, but I've been told. Come on, children, come on. That the streets of heaven. Thank you.
Come on, people, now it's time to go. Go to where a man can dwell. Sometime when I wrote this song, come on children, come on, to remind me well that it won't be long. Come on children, come on, come on children, all come home. Jesus gonna make you well. Come on people, come on, Gabriel, blow that thing. Come on, children, come on. All God's children gonna dance and sing. Come on, children, come on. All God's children gonna sing and shout. Come on, children, come on. There ain't nobody around. One of these days we'll all be there. Come on, children, come on. Seeing those wheels way up in the air. Come on, children, come on. Come on, everybody, now what's it worth? Come on, children, come on. To make a heaven high this earth. Come on, children, come on. Come on, children, I'll come. Jesus gonna make you well. Come on, people, now it's time to go. Go to where a man can dwell. Moses gonna make you well. Even Daniel's gonna make you well. You know Jesus gonna make you well. Mm-hmm. Gonna make you well.
I need to learn it again. I'm doing a thing starting the end of this year and coming into next year where I'm doing a thing with a symphony orchestra. It's going to be called Arlo versus the Symphony. So I need to know how to play stuff. So I'm practicing on you. So here's a little ragtime tune from years ago. One of the first ones I learned. It's called St. Louis Tickle. It goes something like this. Thank you.
My mom was coming back from one of these trips over to China people were making in the 70s or something. And thanks to Nixon. And they were inviting all these artistic types over there, you know. And my mom had been a dancer with Martha Graham Company. And so she got to go and she went over and she come back. She was all excited about it, saying, Arlo, I got to tell you what happened. And she said, we were out in the middle of China. And it was going on, and it took her 2 hours to get to the part of the story she wanted me to hear. She said, Arlo, we were out in the middle of China. And it started, they brought out all these little school kids, and they started singing us songs, and they started singing, This Land Is Your Land. And I said, stop, stop the song. My husband wrote that song. She must have drove him nuts. She was driving me nuts about it. It was weeks after she got back. And I looked at her, I said, Mom, you know, California to the, you know, New York Island. I mean, what are they singing it for over there anyway? She just looked at me with one of those mom kind of looks. She said, oh, Arlo. And I walked away. Feeling my usual dumb self. I knew she was right. I just didn't get it. And I remember not too long after that, I was thinking about it, and it suddenly hit me. I suddenly realized that, you know, just because it says California to the New York Island doesn't mean it has to go the short way. It's true. It could go around back. I could see California, red New York, round that way. Then the whole world could be singing that song. Except America. I remember when I had that thought for the first time, that I realized almost simultaneously that I didn't know any more after thinking than before I'd begun. I never let it stop me. Which brings me to the last verse my dad ever wrote to this song. I learned it out there in the backyard some 40 years ago now. And I'm sure if he was still around, he'd be singing something just about like it today. Especially in countries like China, where people still dreaming about liberty and justice and democracy. Words we got holidays for over here. Even though there's lots of people left in this country still dreaming about some of them very same things. I'll leave you with it. Go something like this. Nobody living can ever stop me as I go walking my freedom highway. Nobody living can make me turn back, cause this land was made. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to New York Island, where the forest and the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for me. The sun come shining as I went strolling. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great night. We'll see you again.